a lot with that. But to parse that out, again, would take at least another hour. So I thank you, Emily. I wish I could have engaged with you, because that actually is really right along the lines of sort of the way I've been thinking about things and sort of the origins, the fear of death, the first patriarchs who couldn't, you know, accept their own death, so they inflict death on others. But gosh, we've run out of time. We only have 30 seconds left. So thank you all for calling. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for paying attention. Please do get involved in the things I mentioned at the beginning of the show. I will go to the computer, I promise, and look them up. Or you can call me at the front desk. I go on front desk duty right now, 503-231-8032. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Halloween Community Rally and the Spirit of Unity on Saturday, October 31st at Waterfront Park in Portland. In the Spirit of Unity will be a family-friendly rally to raise the minimum wage, defend workers' rights, demand renters' rights, and support immigrants' rights. There will be trick-or-treating, costume contests, games, prizes, and music by Portland hip-hop artists. Again, that's In the Spirit of Unity, a Halloween community rally on Saturday, October 31st from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Waterfront Park, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. At 9 o'clock on Political Perspectives, host Doug McVeigh speaks with drug policy expert San Ho Tree about the Drug Czar's office and national drug policy. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, Flashpoints features an in-depth look at the new Speaker of the House-to-be, that's Paul Ryan, and also the weekly broadcast of the Electronic Intifada. And at 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone looks at alternative perspectives on perceptions and treatments of mental illness with John Keyes of Hearthside Healing, Sarah Smith of Rethinking Psychiatry, and Martha Myers. She's formerly with Rethinking Psychiatry. And thank you, KBOO listeners, for your attention. And thank you, members, for your support for Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says donate today. We encourage you to do that ASAP. Thank you very much. And now we're going to go to Doug McVeigh speaking about the Drug Czar's office with drug policy expert San Ho Tree.
You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, on the web at kboo.fm. I'm Doug McVeigh, your host for the next hour. My guest is San Ho Tree. San Ho is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and he's the director of IPS's Drug Policy Project. The project works to end the domestic and international war on drugs and replace it with policies that promote public health and safety, as well as economic alternatives to the prohibition drug economy. San Ho is also a former military and diplomatic historian. He's one of the brightest and best people working on drug policy issues anywhere. And it's my honor to have him today as a guest. San Ho, how are you doing?
Very well, Doug. Thank you very much. Great to be back on KBOO.
Now, tell me about the Institute for Policy Studies.
We're a multi-issue progressive think tank started in 1963 by two members of the Kennedy administration, who, after the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that, and the early Vietnam War, decided things weren't going very well, and they wanted to step out of government and create what was a fairly novel thing at the time called a think tank, to be able to speak truth to power, to be able to tell government when things were going badly and what they needed to do to change things. Because once you enter these large bureaucracies, you know, groupthink takes over, and bureaucracies and petty politics take over. So that's what we've been doing for the past 50 years, is sticking up for social justice issues, both domestic and international. And the drug war is one of those pressing issues that straddles mandate very nicely.
So you're the director of the Drug Policy Project at IPS. How long has that been in operation, and what is the project about?
Well, so I've been doing this since 1998. Before that, I was a diplomatic military historian and worked in human rights and investigative journalism. But since 98, I've worked on both I started out working on the demand side of drug policy in places like East Baltimore, looking at why we choose to use drugs the way we do in this country at such relatively high rates compared to other advanced industrialized countries, and what are some policy responses to that. And shortly after doing that, the Clinton administration started talking about a $1 billion militarized aid package to Colombia, which later became called something called Plan Colombia. And I focused a lot on that for many years. So for the past 15 years, I've been trying to stop this thing called aerial fumigation of coca crops, where we use spray planes to basically defoliate millions of acres of one of the most biodiverse and delicate ecosystems in the world, in a very futile attempt to eradicate coca plants. And in fact, just this week, this was the last week for aerial fumigation in Colombia. So it took 15 years to stop this, and it's been going on off and on for 30 years, actually, but only intensely since 2001. But we finally stopped that. And so I've also worked now more recently on cannabis policy, both domestic and international. It wraps in a lot of other issue areas of harm reduction, of diplomacy, of strategy, development, criminal justice. Drug policy is one of the most interdisciplinary issues I have ever worked on, and that's what makes it so interesting, and also that's what makes it so difficult to solve bureaucratically, because it is broken down into so many different fiefdoms and stovepipes that the right hand doesn't know what the far right hand is doing, and they don't talk to each other, and they fight over budgets, and they're stepping all over each other. So it's I see myself as being able to take several steps back and look at the big picture and say, hey, wait a minute, this whole structure is insane and the objectives are completely irrational. But if you look at it from each bureaucracy's point of view, it's a whole different story, right? They're only focused on what they're focusing on. And so that's how this madness goes on decade after decade.
Right, let's take a look at some of the various aspects. As you said, it's multidisciplinary and covers so much. So let's focus on a couple of areas. For instance, Latin America. Tell me more about some of the work that you've done regarding Central and South America. I mean, you used to lead delegations down to Colombia, as I recall. What was all that about?
For many years, I was on the board of a group called Witness for Peace, which has been around for more than 35 years. It began under the Reagan administration in opposition to the Contra War in Nicaragua. And back then, they were taking U.S. citizens down there to look at the effects of U.S. Counterinsurgency policy and dirty wars. And over the years, they've really broadened their mandate, and they would go to many different countries now and look at all kinds of different social justice issues that are aggravated by U.S. policies. So everything from immigration to the Cuba blockade to the drug war, et cetera. And I used to take a lot of delegations to Colombia and Bolivia to look at the drug war firsthand, meet with farmers, meet with the police, the government, the U.S. embassy, all the different players, the NGOs, as well as indigenous peoples, and looking at it from various perspectives. And then we train people, the delegates, on we don't tell them what to conclude, but we expose them to as many sides as we physically can of the argument. And we give them training on what to do when they get back. You know, whatever your decision is, you should tell people about it. You should do some advocacy. You should talk to local media, talk to your elected officials, et cetera. We give them some of those nuts and bolts skills on how to do that. So that was and I encourage – they still take these delegations. I'm just not personally leading them anymore. But I encouraged people to go to witnessforpeace.org and look at what some upcoming delegations. It's a really fun and novel way to travel, and you'll meet people you would never, ever, ever get a chance to meet with otherwise.
Now, specifically with Colombia, could you talk to me for a bit about how the drug control policy in the U.S. drug war impacts the peace process and the chances for peace in Colombia?
Yeah, so Colombia has been in civil war since I was born, since Lyndon Johnson sat in the White House. So it's the longest running civil war in this hemisphere. And since the late 80s or mid 90s, the guerrillas, which used to be a more of a traditional Marxist insurgency, kind of morphed into a quasi drug trafficking organization, as well as insurgent group. So they do address some social issues, but they've also been seduced by the profits associated with protecting drug traffickers and taxing drug trafficking to fund their war. As by the way, their mortal enemies, the right wing paramilitary death squads associated with the Colombian government and military. So all sides have been involved in the drug trade there. But the drug trade was something that allowed the guerrillas to really amplify and maintain a pace of war that was impossible otherwise. I mean, it's very expensive to fund wars. And with drug revenues, they were able to basically not control, but basically deprive the government of control of about one third of the country. And since the 15 years since Plan Colombia began, much of that territory has been taken back. The guerrillas, however, cannot be eliminated militarily. Colombia is bigger than Texas and California combined, so it's a very big piece of land, right? And it's difficult to eliminate a few thousand guerrillas spread out over such vast territories with jungle cover and all that, and they've been trying for years. So it's simply not possible to defeat them militarily, although they've been weakened. And now there is actually a peace process, and it looks like it's actually going to happen. They've made some tremendous progress thanks to the Cuban government and even the Pope, has intervened. So they've been having these negotiations in Havana for the past couple of years now, and they're actually making a lot of progress. So that is really, really encouraging. The question has been, part of the stumbling block has been, what do you do about these guerrillas, A, who've committed human rights abuses, but also a lot of them were involved in drug trafficking. And so the U.S. Justice Department, of course, has been very hard-line. We want their, we want our pound of flesh, that sort of thing, even if it, screws up the peace process. That's how single-minded some of these drug warriors are. But it looks like they're going to work a lot of this out, and the worst offenders will have some punishment in terms of abuses and massacres and that sort of thing. But as with most wars, they end the negotiating table, and most people are demobilized and are able to go home, which is the only way to stop this thing.
The old phrase, tail wagging the dog. I used to believe that, in a sense, the civil war there was being perpetuated and in part, at least, to help provide cover for the drug trafficking. The traffickers basically paying off both sides to keep up a conflict so that attention could be diverted. Was I being paranoid, or do you think is that legit?
I don't think so much that they needed to pay them off to continue the conflict. I think the dynamics of the conflict were there, and they were going to continue. But drug traffickers love conflict. In various war zones throughout modern history, you see a lot of parallel black market economy going on because black markets thrive under lawlessness. There's easy corruption. You can, get across borders, that sort of thing. And so whether it was Afghanistan or Indochina or Central America or now Colombia, there has always been drug trafficking in these war zones. And of course, various groups have turned to drug trafficking, including the CIA and its allies, to fund illegal wars or secret wars that are off the books. How else can you literally mint your own money to fund very expensive wars? And so the CIA, turned a blind eye in Central America during the 80s, worked with the Northern Alliance, the Jihadin in Afghanistan in the 80s, and turned a blind eye when they turned to poppies. And they did the same thing in Indochina when they're trying to carry out a secret war in Laos and Cambodia. They basically allowed drug trafficking to go on, and opium and heroin were being flown directly into Saigon, where it went indirectly to the veins of U.S. servicemen. So drugs are, it's an easy source of revenue for various armed groups.
I remember we were talking about this years ago when the concern over narco-terrorism was the connection between narcotics trafficking and terror groups. You're making the point. I mean, there are only You know, if you have nothing, then you take what you can from the ground, whether it's minerals or plants you might be able to grow. But there's got to be some way of funding, and that's, yeah.
Yeah, and the drug war and this whole post 9/11 construct of so-called narco-terrorism, I think have been, in many ways, an excuse to fight guerrillas and to fight insurgencies and leftists rather than fight the drug war itself. Not that there was any chance of winning the drug war, but it was a convenient way of selling these controversial policies to Congress to say, we're not getting involved in, you know, Colombia's, you know, five-decade-old civil war. We're only there to do counter-narcotics. And if the guerrillas are involved in that, well, we'll attack them, you know, through that lens. And it was a distinction without a difference. And I've always argued from the beginning that this was as much, if not more, about counterinsurgency than it was about counter-narcotics. And the government was never really honest about that. And to the extent that they've made any progress, yes, they made progress in terms of going after the guerrillas and you know, basically forcing them to the negotiating table. But in terms of the war on drugs, it's been a dismal failure. So that, you know, all they managed to do is push coca cultivation back into Peru and expand it throughout Colombia. So it's really done very little to do anything. And in fact, if you look at the DEA's own measurements of cocaine in the United States, when Plan Colombia began, or the U.S. part of it, in 2001, about 90% of all the cocaine seized in the United States originated from Colombia. They know this from mass spectrometry and gas chromatography. They can identify the exact regions where the cocaine was produced. And in 2012, the DEA, their samples showed that more than 95% of U.S. cocaine was still originating from Colombia. So more of the cocaine in the United States was coming from Colombia after a dozen years of drug war and eradication.
Let's turn to Mexico for a moment. Now, a lot of people are saying that marijuana legalization in the United States could cut into the profits of Mexican cartels. Well, there's a good thing. Others point out that marijuana, while a big business, is just one market and that there are others that are even more lucrative. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I do think it does cut into their revenue streams. But over the years, the various drug trafficking organizations have diversified their revenue streams. So it's no longer just marijuana and cocaine and heroin, but it's also illegal timber and logging or stealing oil from the state oil company or mining or extortion, all kinds of other illicit activities and kidnapping as well. But I think that was triggered in many ways by the war on drugs. So when President Calderon, the previous president of Mexico, launched his disastrous war on drugs in approximately 2006. It was such a disaster, and after 100,000 dead, it became very clear to everyone in Mexico that the state was incapable of preserving order and stopping this stuff. And so it kind of gave the green light to other groups and to cartels to diversify. It's a free-for-all. The state can't stop anything now. So why not get into kidnapping and extortion and all these other things? And that, I think, was really brought to the surface by the failed war on drugs. Before that, yeah, people might have suspected the state is hopelessly corrupt and incapable of doing these things, but there wasn't any way to test it. We helped throw gasoline onto that fire, and everyone realized, hey, the place is on fire. Let's do whatever you want. So it's really hard. It's really easy to destroy the social contract and people's faith in government, and it's very hard to rebuild it. It takes a long time. And that, I think, has been one of the greater tragedies, aside from the human misery and killings, of the drug war.
You said just now we used the words hopelessly corrupt. Do you really think the government there, the police, even the military, hopelessly corrupt?
Not en masse, no. But within each of those branches, yes, there are very corrupt people, including very high level people, from previous drug czars to generals to attorney generals, have all been on the payroll of various drug cartels. So drug prohibition is an equal opportunity corrupter. And, you know, the U.S., we say, well, we're working to vet our allies in the drug war and to make sure we're only, you know, working with clean units and that sort of thing. But you can vet all the colonels and captains you want. But if it's the general or the attorney general or the vice president or the president who's on the payroll of the cartels, then the whole game is lost. All they have to do is sit down and say at the morning staff meeting, OK, tell me who we're going after next. And you've given away the store. Right. And so that's how the cartels have been able to stay ahead of this game for so long, or one of the ways, is that it's very difficult to guarantee the loyalty of the people that we as the U.S. Government finances. And if you can't guarantee people's loyalty at the end of the day, it's best not to arm them and show them how, you know, you go about doing your law enforcement.
You know, in Mexico, Colombia, El Salvador, the U.S. has a very long history of supporting some very bad people. We've militarized large portions of the South and Central American regions. I mean, at one time it was in the name of opposing communism, and now a lot of it is in the context of drug war. You traveled through the region. You do a lot of this stuff. What are your impressions? I mean, how bad has it gotten?
It's gotten quite bad. Well, in many ways, it was worse in the 70s and 80s, before there was the war on drugs. It was the war against so-called Marxist subversion, right? The Cold War. And so in those decades, the U.S. backed a lot of military juntas and death squads and extreme right-wing governments. A lot of people were tortured and jailed and massacred by their own governments, right, with U.S. and CIA support. After the Cold War basically vaporized, after 1989, you see a lot of the formerly the U.S. aid was for counterinsurgency, going after so-called subversives and guerrillas in South America. And then you see a lot of the aid being shifted over into counter-narcotics. This is when, you know, George Bush Sr. and then the Clinton administration are talking about the war on drugs and how this is going to be the new public enemy number one. And places like the we used to be called the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, where the U.S. would train all these Latin American military officers, many of whom have been involved in horrific human rights abuses back in their home countries. Their training curriculum switched from counterinsurgency and anti-communism into counter-narcotics. That became the new way to fund all this stuff. And so in many ways, that was a different way of projecting power throughout the region. For the U.S. And interfering in domestic affairs of various countries. And it's been deeply resented by those countries, or at least by the people of those countries who aren't on the U.S. payroll, at least.
What can we do? What kind of steps do you think that the U.S. can take to undo some of these negatives? I mean, hopefully it's not permanent.
Yeah. And I think I think it's also the failed war on drugs and the activism of many people in the United States to legalize marijuana and to change the mood of this country with regard to the drug war that has opened up a lot of political space in Latin America for people in the region to decide their own fate and to have a greater say and for their governments to be able to stand up to Washington and say, wait a minute. Your own citizens are turning their backs on the war on drugs. You're legalizing this stuff, and you're demanding that we, continue to carry out these very expensive and failed policies that are, you know, alienating our people and not achieving any success. We're not going to do this anymore, and so we're going to find our own way. And so you have various countries now spinning off and taking advantage of that political space. So they are tied in some ways. So Uruguay. Is going to have legal marijuana in pharmacies now. You have various countries decriminalizing drug possession and drug use. Basically they're realizing that this U.S. formula of lock them up and round them up hasn't worked and isn't going to work. There are still countries that are holding out, but also a lot of countries taking advantage of this new atmosphere and this new political space. So don't think that your activism in the United States doesn't carry. It has a far reach in ways that you may not see from day to day. But and in Portland and in Oregon, you've got some really good elected officials, and they can always use some more of a nudge. But they've been very good Congressman Blumenauer, Senator Wyden, these people have been very good on U.S. policy in Latin America in terms of promoting human rights, trying to wean us off this failed drug war, and to deal with to promote policies that actually do improve people's lives. And ultimately, that's the end objective, right? If you're really concerned about drug abuse and addiction, I think the best way to help people is to give people a reason to look forward to tomorrow. And that is missing in a lot of places in this hemisphere, including in the United States, that a lot of folks believe their best days are behind them, and people turn inwards, and all kinds of other social problems come out of that, not just drug abuse and addiction. So ultimately, if you really want to, you know, make a difference, then focus on the root causes of these various problems, which I think are rooted in issues of poverty, despair, and alienation. I call it the PDA problem. But if you address those problems, you address a whole host of other social ills, in my opinion.
Okay, before we leave the region, one last personal question. Planning any more? You planning to go again down to Cuba? I know you're not doing much travel, but now that you've been involved in politics in the region, you've been there, and you now, you know, you were there in D.C. for the historic moment when we actually opened up real diplomatic relations. I mean, this has got to be an incredible time.
It is. I would love to go back to Cuba, but we'll see. Last time I was there was 2003. And actually, the government invited me there to give some talks on drug policy and the failed drug war, which is quite ironic because they were about to launch their own domestic drug war at the time. But, you know, they loved it when I criticized the U.S. drug war and how it's failing and all that stuff. And they were a little bit more cautious when I criticized prohibition itself and the economics behind it. But there you have it. Ironically, throughout the 90s and the aughts, one of the places where the U.S. and Cuban governments were actually cooperating and talking to each other was in counter-narcotics sphere. And so you have the U.S. drug czars historically being the ones who would stick up for Cuba and the U.S. government. Very ironic bedfellows there. But yeah, I encourage people to go to Cuba. And again, Witness for Peace takes delegations there as well.
You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, and KBOO.FM on the web. I'm Doug McVeigh, your host. My guest is Sanho Tree, director of the Institute for Policy Studies Drug Policy Project and a fellow at IPS. All right, let's turn to domestic drug policy for just a moment. Well, actually, for quite a while. At the federal level, the federal fiscal year runs October 1st through September 30th each year. This year, Congress managed recently to pass a continuing resolution mere hours before the fiscal year ended, keeps the government funded through mid-December, I think December 11th. We go through this budget circus every year nowadays, but I digress. I was looking over federal law regarding the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Aside from creating a federal drug control budget each year, that office is required to produce an annual national drug control strategy. Their deadline is supposed to be February 1st, but they've missed that deadline year after year for quite a while. In 2014, the strategy was released in July. Now, we're recording this interview on October 2nd of 2015. The Drug Czar's office has not yet released its annual strategy document. There are a few months left in the calendar year, but looking at the fiscal calendar, ONDCP just missed a pretty big window. This is an entire year, basically, where they have not produced an annual drug control strategy. You know, the thing that they're required to do by law. In the Obama administration's first real official drug control strategy, that was the one issued in May of 2010, the Drug Czar's office laid out a set of goals to be accomplished by 2015. Coincidentally, this year. Those include a 15% reduction in drug-related deaths, a 15% reduction in chronic drug use, a 15% reduction in past month drug use by 12 to 17-year-olds. Well, this is, again, 2015. They've missed those targets pretty badly. Do you think that could be part of the reason they've missed issuing their annual report?
Oh, gee. I'm not a mind reader, but yeah, it certainly does sound like it's kind of embarrassing when you set out targets that you're obviously not meeting and been proven wrong on so many fundamental issues, especially on cannabis prohibition. It's kind of what can they say? Not that many people missed the report. It was never really taken that seriously, other than it was a fig leaf to justify the various budgets for various agencies and that sort of thing, and give up, you know, the appearance of a coherent strategy. But look where it's gotten us thus far. You know, bad news is not something that Washington bureaucracies like to release. And when they do, it's usually we call it taking out the trash, which is to say, you wait for a Friday afternoon at you know 4:59 p.m. when you release an embarrassing you know press release and hope that everyone's gone and no one notices. And in fact, ONDCP used to do this with the drug statistics from Colombia. They used to do this every year, and they wouldn't just pick a typical Friday to do this. They waited until Good Friday for several years when one third of the journalists in DC take the full day off to release those embarrassing numbers. So there's a long history of sweeping things under the rug. And it wouldn't surprise me if this is more of the same.
Do you think the back to their performance targets, which they've been missing, are we even using the right measurements? How should we be measuring our progress as far as substance abuse policy?
That's really important, because historically you had the various agencies and bureaucracies, and especially law enforcement, wanting to have the metrics of success be metrics that were easy for them and profitable for them to meet. That is to say, how many kilos can you interdict? How many people can you arrest? How many people can you prosecute and lock up? That would show, we're headed toward victory, right? That was about as useful as the body count numbers were during the Vietnam War, right? Or during the Iraq insurgency. That if we're killing off this many, allegedly killing off this many enemies, then we must be winning, right? No, because it doesn't take into consideration what's motivating the enemy. That they have no place to go. The Viet Cong, they couldn't go home. They were already home. So they either had to win or they were going to die, right? And the U.S., on the other hand, couldn't maintain a war indefinitely, and we got tired and we went home. Same in Afghanistan, you know, and the early days of the U.S. occupation, the Afghans, the Taliban would say, you have all the watches, but we have all the time. And every insurgent group knows this, right, that sooner or later that the foreigners will lose their morale, they'll go tired, and they'll go home. And meanwhile, the insurgents have nowhere else to go, so they're going to fight, with absolute determination. So it's that kind of dynamic that we keep, perhaps it's our hubris that we think our technology and our wealth and whatever can achieve these results, when in fact, we can't repeal the law of gravity any more than we can. Repeal the law of supply and demand in terms of the drug war.
Now, in each federal budget for quite a while now, we have some federal drug policies being set through the use of riders, the budget amendments that are directed to prevent funds from being spent on one thing or another. For instance, the Justice Department in the last couple of budgets has been directed against spending any funds to interfere with state implementation of state medical marijuana laws. That's a good thing. Personally, I believe the language that's been adopted is really weak, but, you know, generally, it's a good thing. There are bad things, too. There have been amendments for many years forbidding the use of federal funds to implement or operate syringe exchange programs. What do you think about those sorts of tactics as far as drug control policy, just in general, but also as they impact drug policy?
You know, most of these things have been attempts at grandstanding by individual members of Congress trying to make a name for themselves as being tough on drugs, or this is going to be their signature issue that will help them in their district. But the place to form policies is in the subcommittee and then eventually in the committees before it goes to the full body for votes. And that's regular order. You go through a process, and you go to the hearings, and you listen to the witnesses, and that's where you're supposed to you know, shape these things. But you have these opportunists, drug war opportunists, who come in at the last minute and put these riders on, and try to, you know, put their thumb on the scale, so to speak. They've done that, for instance, in Washington, D.C., where the voters legalized marijuana. By a margin of 70%. And here comes this Tea Party representative whose district is in the Eastern Shore of Maryland, where Annapolis and the beaches and all that stuff is. And he doesn't live in D.C. No one in D.C. voted for him. And yet he was able to put a rider forbidding the D.C. government from implementing any kind of regulation with regard to cannabis. So now we have legal cannabis and no regulation, basically. So we're free to grow and to gift, but we can't sell or regulate or tax, which is really stupid when you think about it. Right? This is a prohibitionist member of Congress who basically gave us a libertarian wet dream of legalization without regulation because of their stupid inept politics.
Well, that's a perfect segue. Now, how I'm wondering, how is legalization, the limited legalization you've got there in D.C., rolling out? Here in Oregon, of course, we passed the initiative back in 2014, the same time that D.C. passed its. Ours eventually sets up a regulation and licensing system for the commercial retail sales. We had limited possession and cultivation here went into effect on July 1st. And as of October 1st, dispensaries have been able to sell limited amounts of product to anyone over the age of 21. So dispensaries can get a taste of what that commerce is going to look like, probably to try and convince them to ditch medical and just go for straight up retail. But let's stick with DC. How has the legalization that you've got there been going so far? How's it rolled out?
Well, it's still a bit early, but those who planted their seeds in the spring are now harvesting right now. So this is the time of year when the crop's coming in. I suspect by the holidays there'll be a lot of I think marijuana in D.C. will be the new fruitcake. It'll be a lot of mediocre quality cannabis that people will be regifting to each other over and over again. There'll be a bit of a glut in the short run. I think people are still learning the intricacies and complexities of growing indoors. It's not allowed to grow outdoors in D.C. So indoor growing is tricky. People are starting to learn that it's not just as easy as growing a weed. It takes a bit more investment and care to get a decent crop out. But it's really stimulated the home gardening industry in D.C. You see a lot of apartments with purple LED grow lights, you know, that kind of purplish glow coming out of their windows, that sort of thing. We also had our state fair just recently in D.C. where there was a cannabis contest, a cannabis cup here. They didn't involve smoking, but people presented their samples of their best buds and that sort of thing. So that was kind of novel for D.C. And the medical scene in D.C., well, we've had medical marijuana for a while, but it was so restrictive. There was only four conditions you could qualify for and only certain doctors and that sort of thing. And we've since liberalized that. So that is also going much better now, although the economies of scale are not great in a place like D.C. But the legalization part, I think, we're going to see if we can finally get the city council to adopt some sort of regulation. Congress, it's not a real winning issue for them as a whole. There might be individual members of Congress who live in very reactionary districts where that might help them in their careers and that sort of thing. But for the GOP as a whole, it's not a really good issue. It's they're on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of demographics. That popular opinion is turning and turning quickly. And the people who generally support prohibition are aging and aging quickly and dying off, and so it's not a really winning issue for them. So that's just one more fissure in the GOP civil war going on. Very interesting year politically. I mean, just I don't think anyone could have predicted this. I've never seen anything quite this wild in my entire life of following politics. But you've got a GOP civil war raging on along several axes now, which I never would have predicted. I knew that there was going to be a problem with the libertarian wing versus the social conservative wing, and wedge issues like marijuana would be, you know, front and center for them. But with the Trump phenomenon, he's also opened up another axis to the GOP civil war. So he started a fight between the GOP's donor class, the Roger Ailes, Fox News, and the establishment wing of the GOP party, and the racist Tea Party base that Trump has really mobilized, and actually done some things that are, you know, quite populist, that are anathema to Republican ideology. And so it's got them all wrapped up in these knots. They don't know which way to turn nowadays. So I think it's a fascinating time to be alive and to be watching politics, because what was so predictable and reliable as political wedge issues historically are these old culture war issues, right? Whether it was gay marriage or abortion or the war on drugs or sex or whatever, used to be very reliable wedge issue for Republicans. But now demographically, things are changing, and the millennials and younger generations don't give a toss about any of this stuff. Right. And so they're stuck with all these wedge issues that no longer work for them. But like a zombie, they still keep a lot of them keep repeating this stuff. And what used to be a reliable bludgeon to go after liberals and Democrats with has now turned into a boomerang. It's coming right back at the GOP and splitting the party right down the middle. So that's the interesting thing to watch.
You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, on the web at kboo.fm. I'm Doug McVeigh, your host. My guest, Sanho Tree, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of their Drug Policy Project. It's only October of 2015, and I always get annoyed when people start talking about the election year when it's more than a year out, but I'll just annoy myself. What the heck? How do you see some of these issues playing out as we roll into the next election? The general election, of course, is the presidential circus as well as the Congress. Do you think this is enough to knock out some of the Republicans on the congressional side, or do you see more polarization?
I think it depends on the states, right? Individual states, because it's so different. Whether you're talking about purple states or red states or blue states, but I think that the libertarian wing of the party is expressing itself much more now. Although I think Rand Paul's candidacy has just completely imploded, and he was what we call a lino, libertarian in name only, and so he failed to win over the old Ron Paul wing of the party, because he's made, you know, common cause with a lot of social conservatives and he's anti-abortion, pro-religion, and stuff like that, and so that's alienated a lot of traditional libertarians, and all these new factions that are coming out of the party now. The Trump phenomenon, as disastrous and horrifying and hilarious as it is to watch, has opened up interesting new schisms in the party, especially with when he talks about things like single payer healthcare, or essentially what he's describing, things that are, you know, borrowing from a populist agenda. Though I don't think Trump himself is a populist by any means. So he's just making stuff up as he goes along, including a lot of really, you know, nasty racist stuff as well. But it's really mixing up the politics in a really interesting way. There's the old Chinese curse, right? May you live in interesting times. And this is a very interesting time.
I don't know what it says about me, but I truly believe that the Trump phenomenon is best explained by our national obsession with reality shows. He's just a big reality show, and so he's getting good ratings. Does that translate into presidential power, though?
I don't think it's sustainable, right? There's no there. And when you push him on details, it's, I'm going to be tremendous at this. Oh, I'm going to, you know, grow the economy so much it'll make your head spin. Well, how, Donald? You know, he's got no answers, no skills, and no clear ideas. So it's shallow reality TV. But I don't think he can milk this for another year. So it's, we're really quite early into this process. So I think he will decline. But I think, you know, he's got maybe a 20 to 25% base of support within the GOP. But his and that's his ceiling, but it's also his floor, which is quite interesting. He'll always get that. He's been able to lock on to about 20% very consistently, which puts him in the lead. But he's got incredibly high negatives as well within the GOP and certainly within the population at large. So he'll never, I don't think, win outright. But if he stays in, he could really destroy the GOP. The Republican Party doesn't know what to do with him. And again, all these factions are breaking out and they can't control his message. So it's fascinating time to be alive and watching this stuff. Of course, it's all fun and games until someone gets elected, right? I mean,
Well, let's look at the Democrats for a moment, as difficult as that can be sometimes. Bernie Sanders has said some good things. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders has said some good things. What do you think we're looking at on that side? They're supposed to be the party of social justice. Drug policy reforms are social justice issues. You and I at least know that. Do you think the mainstream Dems have figured that out yet?
I think they're really, I think the mainstream Dems are kind of at a loss. They bet a lot on Hillary. They're surprised by the outpouring of passion, really, really passionate support for Bernie among the base. And so Bernie has broken the 1 million individual donors mark faster than Obama ever did. It's really quite a phenomenon, and he's really catching fire. That really says something when a socialist is beating, Hillary Clinton in the primary states now. And I think, it's a good antidote to so many years of right-wing drift. I think the country's ready for that. And Hillary she's not gaining ground. I predicted a long time ago the email thing would bring her down. Not because there's any smoking gun there, because you can't disprove a positive. And the Republicans will milk it forever, and attribute all kinds of conspiracies and just say, well, she deleted them, so we can't prove it now. But it's something that you can milk forever. And I think that the whole lawyerliness, right? She can't say anything without five qualifiers in the sentence, so you can't pin her down on anything. And I think it's really wearing on people that they want a bit of honesty and just come out and say it. The joke in this town is like, knock knock, who's there? Hillary who? Well, who do you want me to be? Whatever the polls say. And that lack of authenticity, is really, really, really hurting her. It's not that I think she is that inauthentic. It's just that she's a lawyer and she's trained to use all these weasel words and to qualify everything she says. And that's what really undermines her messaging, in my opinion. But I also think it's important that we move beyond Clintons and Bushes, and especially that generation. It's the baby boomer generation that has dominated U.S. politics for so long. It's always been about them. And their culture war wedge issues that came out of the 60s, essentially, and have served them well for four decades in terms of how they want to, fling mud at each other in politics and that sort of thing, those issues are wearing out. And they should wear out. We should be done with this stuff about, gay rights and marijuana and these other wedge issues. But as long as we have that generation still in power, still fighting for political control, we will be saddled with their wedge issues for yet another election cycle, another administration. And I don't think we can afford that. We need to move beyond these old food fights that are so synonymous with the Clinton name, actually. And I think if we don't move beyond that to the next generation, and even though Bernie Sanders is older, he represents issues that resonate with a new generation and has moved. He was never part of that old culture war gang. So for that reason, I think it's important to move beyond that. We're done with the drug war. We're done with these social, the divisions over race and all this other stuff. It's not to say that political, hacks won't find new wedge issues to divide people and to unite them, but it'll be a different set of wedge issues. Maybe clash of civilizations, maybe Second Amendment, maybe, you know, something along those lines. But marijuana, gay rights, all that stuff, we're done with that.
Interesting. You mentioned a moment ago that Sanders having ignited the passion of the progressives, and some time ago, Hillary Clinton was talking about how to make lasting change. She said that she believed you could change people's minds about issues, you know, gay rights and the rest, gay marriage, but changing people's hearts, well, now that's just not going to happen. I think that speaks to, well, exactly what you were saying, the lawyer training, the weasel words, and a real just lack of understanding. How do we ignite the passion in people to make some of these progressive changes in drug policies?
I think there are a lot of people who are progressive in their outlook and are natural allies on many of these issues. Perhaps they don't realize it yet, because a lot of the solutions, the problems we look at are counterintuitive. They're difficult, slightly more difficult to message than the instant knee-jerk, you know, reactionary message, which is what the drug war has been all about historically. That it's counterintuitive to think, well, maybe by not escalating prohibition, we make the drugs less valuable, that we can, you know, create less of incentive. We could stop amplifying the motivational feedback loop of the very people we're trying to stop, you know, because prohibition only makes drugs more valuable. And of course, it's going to draw more people into it. And so with the drug war and many other controversial issues, I think that the data and the studies and the facts have been on our side for many, many years. It's just that we lack sufficient, talent or skills to message this stuff to a wider audience. Liberals very often are taught to, you know, respect knowledge and academia, and, well, you listen to academics, what do they say? Well, they use a lot of jargon. They use things to impress themselves. They like complexities. And these are all things that don't really help when you're talking about political messaging to a wider audience, right? You have to learn how to communicate in the vernacular, in language that people can understand. And so the reward mechanisms in academia and in these elite policy circles, et cetera, place a value on, you know, complexity, Germanic sentence structure, passive voice, jargon. These are all deadly when you want to communicate politically. So I think we need to focus more on messaging and training people how to talk to people who don't already agree with you, right? And I think that's the problem with the left in general, that we're very good at preaching to the choir. We're not so good at preaching to the unconverted. And me personally, if I had a choice between talking to a group of progressives or talking to a group of right-wing Republicans, I'll take the Republicans any day of the week. Not because I enjoy it more. Well, I do actually enjoy it. It keeps me on my toes and sharp. But those are the people we need to win over, right? Those are the people, if you ever want to make any progress, you have to win over people who don't already agree with you. The people who are already on your side, yeah, you can, you know, let them know about urgent action alerts and when to take action and stuff, but they're basically with you on these issues. So why do we keep spending our resources on that? You know, it's kind of like, a little bit like the Black Lives Matter movement targeting Bernie originally, you know? It was not the most brilliant strategic move, in my opinion. It's like the old chant, you know, what do we want? We want change. When do we want it? Right now. Well, who are we going to change? Well, we're going to change people who basically agree with us 99% on all the issues, but we're going to crucify for that 1% we disagree with. Meanwhile, you've got all these other candidates who aren't even close, right? That's who you should be focusing on. And if you want to win any political issue, you've got to bring people over to your side and not just purge, you know, your own side and getting more ideological purity. And you end up with smaller and smaller numbers. I don't do vanguard politics. I think it's a waste of time and it's very, very counterproductive. So learning how to communicate is really important. I think the most subversive and radical book ever published in the English language was the Bible. and I say this as a heathen, right? Because it used to be only printed in Latin, and it was a death penalty offense for anyone to translate the Bible into their local native language, because that's how the priests and the clergy held on to their power, and that's how the kings and the feudal structure, you know, rested on this whole, you know, basically conspiracy theory. And they would tell the peasants, well, your reward is in the afterlife. Don't complain about anything here and now. And then when people started reading the Bible in English, they like, wait a minute, you know, Jesus was talking about a lot of the social justice issues and stuff. And here and now, and they start asking questions. And so it leads to the Reformation, and it just shakes up and completely eventually breaks down the feudal structure of the Middle Ages. So there is power in being able to speak clearly and simply. But you won't learn that in academia.
Sano, we're running up to the end of the hour. Do you have any closing thoughts? And do remember, please, to let us know where they, where our listeners can find out more about the work that you're doing, a website and all that, your Twitter.
Sure. The easiest way to keep up with me is on Twitter. I spend a little too much time on Twitter. My handle is just @SanhoTree. And my office website is www.ips-dc.org. And I'll also be speaking at the Drug Policy Alliance conference in Washington coming up in November on a social media panel. So if people are in town, come on by.
We've been going to these conferences for so very long. How much good do you think they do, really?
Actually, I do think they do a lot of good. Maybe not so much in the early days. In the early days, I remember it was very, very white, very male, very libertarian, very insular. And I think Drug Policy Alliance, when they took it over, really made an effort to do some outreach to local legislators, the state and municipal and federal level, to communities of color. They brought in, you know, a lot of people from all different communities, harm reduction. And so it's not just these, you know, white male libertarian stoners, quite frankly, that used to dominate this thing, this movement, when you and I were doing this years ago. So I think it really speaks to the traction we're getting on drug reform throughout our society.
Give us an idea what you think we should be undertaking in the short and medium term that can help us in establishing a more rational drug control policy.
Boy, easy questions. There are a lot of things, but it starts with the individual. It starts at the local level. People think they need to come to Washington to lobby. They don't. And in fact, it's probably more effective if you do it at home. People come to march in D.C. all the time, and we get lots of demonstrations and marches. And a lot of progressives, especially young leftists, don't want to get their hands dirty with politics. They don't want to lobby Capitol Hill, right? They just want to come and shout at the government. But what happens is that these members of Congress look out their window, and they see a bunch of people with spiked hair and you know, tattoos and multiple piercings, and they think, oh, they're not from my district. They're from Barbara Lee's district in you know, the Bay Area or whatever. But in fact, many of them are from Peoria. They're from the Midwest. They're from all kinds of different places. But if you don't take a moment to actually stop into your representative's office and tell them that you spent a lot of money to come to D.C. to express themselves, and they're going home to their district, and they'll continue to organize in their district, so they better take their concerns seriously. That's how you begin to make progress. So throwing a tantrum is different from changing a policy, and it requires some things that are not that glamorous or fun necessarily, and lobbying is one of those things. You have to let your representatives know how you feel, and at the local level, that's the easiest thing you can do. Is to ask for a meeting or write a letter or meet with their staffers or members. These are not only your right, but in many ways your responsibility, in my opinion. So you can't lobby someone else's senator or congressman. You can only lobby your own because they are accountable to you. And so that, you know, nuts and bolts, 101, how do you actually do the care and feeding of legislators? How do you actually work with them? So that's one of the things I do is give workshops around the country on not what to lobby on, but how to lobby it on issues. Most people were never taught in their schools how to make change, right? And I don't think that's an accident. and that's true of all countries, basically. Governments don't – they just want you to vote them into power, and once they're in power, they don't want to hear from you so much anymore. lest you mess anything up for them or upset their agenda. But it is not only, you know, it's a responsibility and a right that a lot of people fought for. It's a shame more people don't exercise that right. Because how else are your representatives going to find out how you feel about things? They don't commission polls in their district every time there's an issue to be voted on. So they extrapolate. They want to know, well, how many calls did we get about this issue from our constituents? How many letters? How many faxes? How many visits? How many letters to the editor in a local paper? Letters to the editor, the most widely read section of the local paper. And representatives read that section. So, you know, even if you only write a letter to the editor, that's important. And even if your letter to the editor doesn't get published, you can CC it to your representative or their staffer. And you let them know that, hey, maybe they didn't publish your letter this time, but, you know, you live in their district and you're taking time out of your busy day to express your views. And next time they will publish your letter, or that you'll be talking to your colleagues, your coworkers, your friends, your churches, your unions or whatever. And so they better pay attention to you. The squeaky wheel gets the oil, right? And so you got to squeak.
And that is as good a spot as any to bring this show to a close. I have been speaking with Sanho Tree. He is the director of the Drug Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. It's been a great pleasure, Sanho. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Doug. Always a pleasure.
I'm Doug McVeigh, your host. You're listening to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. KBOO.FM on the web. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
And thanks, KBOO members, for your support of listener-supported community radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO.FM and clicking where it says Donate Today. Stay tuned at 10:15 this morning on KBOO. Flashpoints features an in-depth look at the new Speaker of the House-to-be, Paul Ryan, and the weekly broadcast of the Electronic Intifada. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, today looks at alternative perspectives on perceptions and treatments of mental illness. But first, we're going to go right to Air Cascadia. Chris Andre is waiting in the wings, and stay tuned.